peace, love, and blessings, everyone. Welcome back to the Spirits and Poetry Podcast, episode number 2. Today, we're talking about themes, tropes, archetypes, and mythology. If you're a longtime supporter, or whether you're a first-time listener, please do me a favor of supporting the podcast by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts, and even dropping a follow on Instagram at The Spirits and Poetry. And if you would like to help the creation of this show, check in the description for the PayPal, Venmo, whatever links in case you would like to donate. But as I said last episode, your presence here with me is way more than enough. It is a blessing to be alive, especially with, I mean, of course, it's Mercury retrograde, it's Pluto retrograde, Saturn's in retrograde. I think Jupiter might be in retrograde. Everybody's in retrograde. The world's falling backwards, it feels. Chaos everywhere. Are you getting comfortable in the chaos? Because I'm not. But themes, tropes, archetypes, and mythology. I wanted to choose this as a second episode because last time we talked a lot about the individual experience and individual realities and how art brings people together. This episode, I wanted to focus on the collective human experience, what some people refer to as the collective unconscious, because we all suffer. That's the collective human experience, suffering. We're all longing, we all desire. That's what the Buddhists say. We all struggle and suffer in this world because we are full of desire. And art is how we can communicate that suffering. So how does art communicate suffering? Through themes, tropes, and archetypes. The themes of art, the themes of poetry. I mentioned this before. My high school English teacher talked about how every single poem is either about sex or it's about death. One or the other. Sometimes both, but it's either about sex, the longing for connection, longing for experience or love of a bringing things together. And here's actually a quote by Robert Hass from his poem, Meditation at Lagunitas. Longing, we say, because desire is full of endless distances. I must have been the same for her, but I remember so much. The way her hands dismantled bread, the thing her father said that hurt her, what she dreamed. There are moments when the body is as numinous as words. We are social creatures, man. We crave connection. We are lonely in our individual experience. We suffer for love. And in the words of a good friend and fellow poet, the things we do for love, the things we've done for love, and all things come to an end. That's why a lot of poems, a lot of art is about death. It's about decay, things coming to the end, the ends of cycles. It's about destruction, the deconstruction of things. And in honor of that, here's actually a poem that I wrote. It's called Everybody Dies, and it's from a poetry book that I'm actually working on as we speak. Everybody dies. Death to an undocumented kid is consolation. It's the promise that the cage will one day open. Sometimes I envy the birds. Their flight is the perfect metaphor for my broken Spanish. I can't watch the news anymore. It's become a way to die without dying. It's the cage that never opens for anybody. The first time I saw the border wall, I tried counting all of the white crosses on it. I lost count at 369. I pretended they were my cousins and said goodbye to each one. I had survived what they didn't, which made us family. I have a friend who asked me why I'm obsessed with death, but I can never answer him clearly. All I see are white crosses and a rusty wall and all of my cousins holding a door open for me. We are mortal beings. We are on a time clock. We suffer because we want. We suffer because we long. Because we know that everything's impermanent. We built families, clans, villages, cities, societies, countries to band together to increase our chances of survival. But death is the ultimate equalizer. And in art, it is a heavy theme. In this poem, you can feel it was a very heavy theme about dying, about immigration being a death, about being undocumented and dying, decaying here. So every theme in art, to me, is about either connection or destruction. And that's what life is about. We build things and they die. We are born and we die. And this is what living is about. Accepting this cycle, no matter how cool it may seem. So what kind of tools can you use to communicate this depressing reality? That's where tropes come in. Tropes are tools. They're figures of speech, which speakers and writers use to express words in a way that is different from their literal dictionary meanings. And bear with me for this little section, which might feel a little bit like English class, but examples of tropes are irony, hyperbole, metaphors, similes, personifications, allegories, litotes, metonymies, and synecdoches. Let's start with the ones you might be familiar with, like irony. When things happen that are unexpected, like an Olympic swimmer drowning in their bathtub. Hyperboles are exaggeration for the purpose of expressing something, like saying that Shaq is 20 feet tall because man's as big. Hands is big. Metaphors and similes are comparison because it's when we're able to bring two things together and show their similarities or differences that we can increase our understanding about something. Personification is giving human-like qualities to inanimate things, like saying that your phone has hands and it holds your fingers to the keyboard. It's a beautiful way of description. Allegories are stories with a lesson. Like, for example, Bug's Life. The lesson is that it doesn't matter how weak one ant is, when you have a million ants, they are unstoppable. Litotes, metonymy, and synecdoche. Words that I am not 100% sure I am pronouncing correctly. And these are actually some that I was not familiar with myself. A synecdoche is when a part of a thing or idea represents the whole. So, for example, if you want to write a poem about a lover, but instead of referring to them by name, you're just referring to them by their hands. And so in this case, the hands represents the whole lover, and you're only describing them by their hands because, I mean, hands tell a whole story. Are they rough like you've worked your whole life, or are they soft and tender like you've never lifted a finger? A litote, it's the opposite of a hyperbole. It's an understatement. It's like saying that the healthcare system in the United States is just a little disorganized. Metonymy. A metonymy is a trope where an alternate name takes place of the original idea. So, like, referring to the government as the man, referring to a king as the crown. You have this phrase, this alternate name that then takes on so much symbolism, like saying that the man is keeping me down. Referring to the presidential administration as the White House. You're able to add so much connotation to a word, and all these tools you can use to enhance the words that you are using, to enhance the themes that you are then playing with, which gets us into the fun stuff. This is where the fun comes in, because we are going to talk next about archetypes and archetypal symbols. This is fun because tropes actually communicate archetypal information by comparing, negating, transforming, understating, enhancing the words around a symbol. So what is an archetype? Archetypes are universal symbols, universally applicable characters, terms, settings, actions that represent a pattern that we can then recognize. So they are themes and images that appear in literature, movies, art, that helps us as viewers understand the connections with the human experience, our collective suffering. Because remember, every story has already been told. Our job as artists is not to come up with a unique story that no one's ever heard of, but to take the common journeys that we are familiar with and to bring them into our current reality. So in the U.S., we are experiencing the breakdown of the presidency, of healthcare, of money, politics itself. People are scared, frustrated, worried, angry, feeling betrayed by our leaders. Everyone in this country feels this in some way, shape, or form, and this is true in every country. So we take familiar journeys, and we modernize them. We bring them to the present. So what are these archetypal journeys that are so common? And as I state them, you'll know what I'm talking about. You've seen these. There's the quest for identity, the epic journey to find the promised land. There's the vengeance quest, the warrior's journey to save his people. There's the search for love to rescue a princess or damsel in distress. There's the journey for knowledge, the tragic quest for penance or self-denial like Hercules. There's the fool's errand, right? Looking for something that is not there, something that is not going to make you happy or bring you whatever it is that you want. There's the quest to rid the land of danger. There's the quest for human perfection. All of these are stories that have been told in some way, shape, or form and will always be applicable, which leads us into archetypal characters. There's the rebel, like Tyler Durden in Fight Club or Robin Hood or Neo in The Matrix. These are characters that are unsatisfied with the status quo. They are determined to make their own way through life. You have the lover, like Jack from Titanic or Romeo and Juliet, who are motivated by another person who spend their entire story avoiding confrontation because their goal is to return to their lover. You have the orphan, which is an archetypal character used in a lot of superhero stories, where they have a tragic backstory and they lack familial support, and they got to confront all that to then step beyond themselves, like Harry Potter or Batman or Spider-Man. There's a mother figure, the warrior, the child, the creator, the mentor, the magician, sage. There's the ruler. There's the seducer. These are characters that you will see over and over and over because they speak to a deep human truth. And here's an astrological secret for you artists. If you want your story to blow up, write about a planet's exaltation, because the planets themselves are also archetypal characters. There's Mercury, the messenger. The sun, the savior. Venus, the lover. The moon, the mother. Mars, the soldier. Jupiter, the king. And Saturn, the father. If you're familiar with astrology, you will know that these seven characters are in every single story. Maybe not all of them present at once, but they're there. And you can see this. And when you start peeling back the layers, you realize that every story is about these planets, the same archetypal characters. For example, the hero's journey. It's about the sun's exaltation in Aries. The sun, the child, the heart, the chosen one, leading the charge against an oppressive force. Often Saturn, the father, the old guard, the old oppressive laws. This is Luke Skywalker versus the Emperor and the Empire. This is Harry Potter versus Voldemort and the Death Eaters. This is Neo versus the Matrix, the chosen one, who leads with their heart, who is doing something absolutely new and different. Luke Skywalker, Harry Potter, and Neo are there to do things differently than everyone who has come before them. And the system or the antagonists they're opposite against are entities with a strong set of laws. Saturn, the Emperor, wears black. Agent Smith, the agents, they wear black, right? The Death Eaters wear black. That's Saturn's colors. And there's other exaltations. There's the moon's exaltation in Taurus, Mercury's exaltation in Pisces. Mars exalted in Capricorn is awesome because that's the warrior story. You have Jupiter exalted in Cancer, Saturn exalted in Libra. When you tap in to the energies of these archetypal entities who represent humanity at its finest or at its worst, your stories will undoubtedly connect with people. And if you want proof, let's take a look at mythology. Mythology is full of symbols, tropes, themes. They are full of archetypal characters that teach us lessons, that speak to our human longing, to human greatness. Today we're going to be talking about Norse mythology because I've been very into it. I watched the show Vikings for the first time from beginning to end. I knocked it out in like 3 weeks, and wow, what a fantastic show. Then I started playing Assassin's Creed Valhalla, and yo, Norse mythology is where it's at. I never forgot my experience with God of War 4 because, yeah, Norse mythology is where it's at. So the character, the archetypal being we're going to be focusing on today is Odin, the Allfather, because his story is the story of fighting against fate. So many mythologies feature a pantheon of gods where one of them acts like a king or the ruler of the gods. So the Greeks had Zeus, the Romans had Jupiter, the Egyptians had Amun, the Hindi have Indra, but the Norse gods, the Aesir, they had Odin, the Allfather, known by 200 different names from tribes and people across Scandinavia and so on and so forth. And so in Norse mythology, the origin story goes a little bit like this. In the beginning, there were only two realms, one filled with cold mist and the other with raging flames. And there was a primordial void between them. The two elements then combined and formed the first Jotun, the first giant named Ymir. And from that void there was also a great cow, which fed Ymir. And from his sweat came more giants, and from the cow licking the salt of the ice came the first Aesir god known as Buri, who married a Jotun and gave birth to three sons, one of them who was Odin. The three brothers then killed Ymir, and the blood of the giant was so great that it drowned the cow that fed him as well all the other giants. The brothers then used the corpse of the giant to create the earth. They used his flesh for soil, his bones for mountains. From his teeth, they shaped boulders and stones, and they cracked the skull open to make the sky. And they used sparks of the realm of fire to create the stars and the sun. And they kept creating until later they wanted beings to worship them. So they made humans, and then they shaped their heaven-like Asgard to watch over them. And then Odin married Frigg, a goddess who knows the fate of all. And he is also the father of Baldur, the god of light, who is said to be so beautiful and a god who can never die. And he's also father to Thor, god of thunder, who you see in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And he is also blood brother to the Jotun Loki. They're actually blood brothers, not father-son, as Marvel likes to tell it. But who is Odin? And why are we focusing on him? Odin is characterized by his relentless pursuit of knowledge, of wisdom, for power. So very early on, he goes to the world tree Yggdrasil and he hangs himself upside down from the branches with a spear in his chest, and he hangs there for 9 days. Very Jesus-like, if you think about it. But he hangs there until the runic letters reveal their mysteries to them. And these runes, the magic, they make him wise and strong, one of the strongest in all the realm. But he only wanted more wisdom and knowledge. And so he goes to the Well of Wisdom, which is controlled by a Jotun. And he convinces this giant to allow him to drink from the waters. But he has to sacrifice something. And so what he does is he plucks out one of his eyes, places it in the well, and he drinks. And from this water, he becomes the wisest of the wise. There are different events that lead up to Ragnarok. Ragnarok is the foretold cycle of end of time, followed by rebirth. So essentially, the world prospers, and then it decays, and then Ragnarok comes, and it's Armageddon. But there is no empty void again. No, The world is reborn. The gods are reborn. Everything happens as it happened before, but there will be another Ragnarok, followed by more rebirth, and then Ragnarok, and rebirth, and then Ragnarok until the end of time. But this was the first Ragnarok. The events happen when Loki finally succeeds in killing Baldur, and so Odin in his fury turns against Loki, and this just speaks to in the world of people, brother, we're turning against brother. The gods knew that their time was dwindling. Yggdrasil began to wilt. Brother turns against brother. Odin and the Aesir gather all the strongest warriors in Valhalla because the Jotun, the giants, have been growing so bold and growing their strength. And they finally charge against Asgard. And meanwhile, in the world of people, there's only war and ruin. And Ragnarok comes. And the first clash is Thor against the world serpent Jormungandr. And it is a bloody fight from start to finish. And Odin, he takes his vast army of the bravest warriors humanity has ever known. And he leads them in war against the Jotun. But Thor dies. The warriors die. And Odin is swallowed by the wolf Fenrir and the world tree Yggdrasil. Falls into darkness. And then the world is reborn. And so this happens time and time again. And so what Odin becomes obsessed with this, with the fact that he believes that he can one day achieve the knowledge and the power to stop Ragnarok from happening, to stop this cycle of end, to continue in eternal prosperity, to continue to live. And not be swallowed by a wolf, which is, fun fact, that is actually Loki's son. And he does all he can to avoid his fate. He takes the wolf Fenrir and he chains it up, he imprisons it, and he tortures it, and he tricks it, and he tries to do magic on it, but no matter what he does, Ragnarok always comes and he is always swallowed by the wolf. How many of us are in a fight against our fate or what we perceive our fate to be? How many of us believe in a destiny or believe that we are fated for something or are afraid that we are fated, and no matter how hard we try, we can never escape that fate? How can we make sense of the workings of a universe that are far beyond what we can understand? We can do it through stories, through poems, through paintings, where we tell stories of legendary warriors or of God or of a trickster or a rebel warring his fate. It's when we tap into these themes of art and we use the tropes to frame our stories of archetypal humans that speak to our subconscious wants and fears and desires. That is when we approach a mythic status, because we humans are all that are left from the time of gods and giants and great serpents, and our stories prove it. Peace, love, and blessings to you all. Thank you for sticking through me through this episode. It is an absolute blessing to continue with season 3. Episode 3 is going to be about artistic honesty and living in the present, and that'll be out in another 2 weeks. But may you all continue to move with love and gratitude. Thank you for tuning in. Remember to support the podcast by rating on Apple Podcasts or following on Instagram at The Spirits and Poetry. And if you would like to donate, there's going to be information in the description. But see y'all next time. Take care.